even if he didn't sell 72 million recordings, make 15 gold albums, and 5 number one hits, Herb Alpert would still be a music industry icon. For while he's best known as the trumpet player behind the instrumental pop sounds of the Tijuana Brass Group of the 1960s and 70s, his role as a record producer is also legendary. A co-founder of A&M Records, he went on to sign and record superstars from Sergio Mendes to the Carpenters, Cat Stevens, Peter Frampton, and Sting. Now 83, Alpert is still as active as ever, both as a musician, as a visual artist, and as a philanthropist, supporting music education programs at UCLA and CalArts. Now World Records in Bakersfield is bringing Alpert and his wife Lonnie Hall, former singer with Brazil 66, to the Central Valley for a concert Thursday, May 24th at the Bakersfield College Outdoor Theater. Herb joins us now on Valley Public Radio. Herb, welcome.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me.
So take us back to Los Angeles in the days you were growing up, before you founded the Tijuana Brass, before you became an influential record producer. What were the sounds that were around you in that day? What sort of led you on the path that that eventually led you to stardom?
Well, it depends on what period you're talking about. You know, when I was 8 years old, I had this incredible experience at my grammar school in Los Angeles, where there was a music appreciation class, and there was a table filled with instruments, and I happened to pick up a trumpet, and the trumpet was talking for me because I'm an introvert, basically, and as a kid, I was kind of a mute, and so like when this horn was making this sound, it was talking for me, and that experience really obviously changed my life. It led me into a lot of different directions. So in the early days, you know, I was studying classical music, studying with some classical trumpet players, and then I got, you know, listening to Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis and some of the great jazz musicians, and I decided that's what I want to do. I want to close my eyes and just play whatever comes out. I just want to invent. And so that's what I've been pursuing. But the music that I was hearing when I was growing up was, you know, like, well, in the early days, it was Harry James, and then it was, Miles and Louis Armstrong. You know, I went through a period of trying to play like these people, only to realize that who wants to hear that? They've already done it. So I was in pursuit of finding my own voice on the trumpet, and that, came about in the early 60s.
And you certainly did that with the founding of the Tijuana Brass. How did that project develop? And did you have an idea of what you wanted to do and set out to accomplish that? Or was it more of something that evolved and then became this huge sensation?
Yeah, I think, you know, luck plays such an important part in one's progression. I used to go to bullfights in Tijuana for about 3 years every spring. And there was I never listened to mariachi music, but there was a brass band in the stands. And they would introduce all the different events at the bullfight, you know, like ba-da, ba-da-da, ba-da-da, ba-da, band, and the bull would charge out of the gates. And then, you know, they'd announce the matadors and the toreador, the picadors, blah, blah, blah. And it was exciting for me. And I tried to translate the feeling of those afternoons to a song. It was a song written by a friend of mine, and it turned into The Lonely Bull. And that was the first record we released on A&M Records. That was the start of A&M Records.
And did you have an idea that, wow, this has some ability to connect with the record-buying public? Did you have an inkling of where it was going to go?
I was hopeful that it would catch on, but you know, you never know. I never tried to make hit records. I tried to make good records. I tried to make music that touched me, and I felt that, you know, if I can be touched by the music I make, maybe there'll be some other people that might feel the same way.
You talk about the founding of A&M Records, hugely successful, and so many different artists and different genres. How did you go about learning the record business? Was that something? Hey, tell me about that.
Well, see, I'm a right brain guy. I'm 85% on the right side of my head because I paint, I sculpt, I make music, And I have a talent of surrounding myself with the right people, with people that can do things that I can't. And I was lucky to have a partner, Jerry Moss at A&M Records, that, you know, he could shore up all those things I didn't have. And then, you know, I had an amazing experience, positive and negative experience. I was recording for a major company before A&M Records, and I didn't like the way I was being treated. They were treating me not like an artist, but like a commodity. I was a number to them. When we were in the recording studio, I was 38257, take two. You know, I didn't have a name. And so I filed all that, and when it came time for my chance with my own record company, I made the artist. The artist, it was, the A&M Records revolved around the artist. It was the artist first. It was a company that was very sensitive to the needs of an artist, and we felt if we would sign artists that were not necessarily the beat of the week, not necessarily the artists that were happening at the time, but artists that had something uniquely special to say, we would be successful, and that's what we did.
Yeah, what was the A&R approach there, A&R being the record industry term for developing talent and finding the right material and performers for a label? Just with the way the record industry has changed, it's hard to imagine where we are today, how it might have been back in the 60s when A&M was, you know, bringing everyone from Sergio Mendes to the Carpenters to the label. Was it hard to resist the financial pressures to go in one way and do, as you say, look the long game and try to get those artists who might not be the flavor of the month but might have a longer return?
Well, you know, we were very fortunate, or I was very fortunate, because when the Tijuana Brass took off and we started selling millions of records and CDs, it gave us the freedom to be able to just, you know, pick and choose. We weren't desperate. And we were always after that artist that had unique talent. You know, like Cat Stevens, The Police, Carpenters, you mentioned. We had, you know, Quincy Jones, Janet Jackson, Supertramp, Peter Frampton. We had, you know, a bevy of wonderful artists. And in 1966, I auditioned with my partner, Jerry, Sergio Mendes in Brazil 66, and we signed them to a long-term contract. And you know, they were not the beat of the week, but I remember when I heard this music from Brazil, it was really intriguing. It was like a hybrid, you know, a little bit of Brazilian jazz, American jazz, classical music, African music. It had all these elements, and had no idea that the public was going to take to them, but we liked them, and that was good enough. So we felt if we could make good records, good, you know, give the public something that they might respond to, maybe the timing was right. But in answer to the question, I think timing is the whole game. You know, you got to be at the right place at the right time. If we tried to start A&M Records in today's environment, musical environment, it would have no chance, I don't think. We were very fortunate to be at the right place at the right time.
There's a lot of debates in society today about so-called cultural appropriation and whether it's off limits for artists to incorporate elements of other traditions or other cultures into their work and come up with something new. A lot of the material that your artist produced, it drew on different influences. You just talked about how Sergio Mendes combined all of these different ideas, your influence going to those bullfights and hearing the mariachi music in Tijuana leading to the Tijuana Brass. What do you think about that idea that's out there today about, you know, just given all the different influences that are out there? Is it a beneficial thing or should people be striving for a certain purity in traditions that maybe are exclusive to one culture?
Ah, no, it really opens the door to something very beautiful. World music is, we borrow from, we did that with classical music. I mean, nobody has a hold on, you know, everyone is dealing in the Western lexicon. We're dealing with 12 notes, man. It's the same notes that Bach had, the same notes that Beethoven had, same notes that, Charlie Parker had, the same notes that Thelonious Monk had. You know, there's 12 notes, and you can scramble them up in lots of different ways and with lots of different rhythms and different, you know, permutations. And I think that's the fun of it all. We borrow. And it's a global society now. Everybody is pretty in tune with what's happening because of the Internet. So I think to be able to incorporate the different influences from different parts of the world is beautiful.
We're talking with Herb Alpert today on Valley Public Radio. He's performing with Lonnie Hall Thursday, May 24th at the Bakersfield College Outdoor Theater, presented by World Records. Speaking of how different cultures and different traditions incorporate things, how did you feel when you heard hip-hop artists start to sample your recordings?
Well, at first I wasn't so crazy about it because, you know, I like artists who have their own, you know, concept, their own ideas in terms of rhythms and grooves. And some of these artists, you know, had no musical experience, but they could take someone else's backdrop and put something on it. But, you know, as it kind of matured, I can understand why it's happening. And, you know, it's a cyclical event. Music changes from time to time. You never know what it's going to be like. For me, there was a little lack of melodies. It feels like on the radio you'd hear boom, 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 four to the floor. And there was like a little, it needed a little energy, how can I put it? Where's the meat? Where's the beef?
You've been very active in recent years through philanthropy and music education, especially with CalArts, with the UCLA School of Music, which bears your name, with Thelonious Monk Institute. Tell me a little more about how you're trying to give back and what you see as your legacy there.
Well, I think it's a really kind of a dangerous and fragile state we're in right now. The leadership of our country, they don't seem to have a clue about the importance of the arts in our society. The artists kind of define who we are, and boy, we can't lose that. That's what this country is all about. This country was formed by creative people, innovative people, and we need to make sure that these artists survive and are able to do what they have to do to identify us. So, you know, I had this opportunity when I was 8 years old, and I feel like all kids should be able to rub elbows with something creative at a real early age. It's a win-win situation because, you know, if they paint, sculpt, or play an instrument, poetry, acting, it doesn't really matter. As long as they can get some creative juices out and they start feeling good about themselves, they might be able to appreciate their own uniqueness. And then fingers crossed, they might be able to appreciate the uniqueness in others. And I think we need a lot more of that.
You've had incredible success as both a performing artist and a record producer in the industry. You're at a point right now in your career where you don't need to tour, don't need to do concerts. Why do you to go out and you know perform on tour, go to places like Bakersfield? Tell me a little more about what you get out of being on stage at this point in your career.
It's not about I need to do it. I have to do it. I love to do it. I mean, it's something that's instilled in me, and I have this very fortunate career because I think, you know, luck plays an enormous part in the success of an artist. And I was at the right place at the right time. I sold a lot of records, as you mentioned, and I feel like there are a certain amount of people that would like to hear my music.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel great doing it. I practice every, you know, look at. You know, I do this every day because, you know, it's not something I have to do, but I do have to do it. You know, it's like, you know, Dizzy Gillespie was a friend of mine, and Dizzy used to say, he said, the closer I get, the farther it looks. and that's about the way it is with being a musician. You never get to that place where you say, I got this covered. This is a done deal. You know, now and then we probably all run across these geniuses who are just whiz at what they do and what they've accomplished, and they probably don't think that same way. But, you know, most people that are just, you know, good musicians are always trying to, you know, get to that perfect place that you never arrive at.
We've been talking with Herb Alpert today. He is performing Thursday, May 24th in Bakersfield. Herb Alpert and Lonnie Hall at the Bakersfield College Outdoor Theater. World Records in Bakersfield presenting that show. And we're really excited to have you coming to the Central Valley. Herb, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been our pleasure.
Yeah, I hope to see people out there with they're not, believe me, they will love our show. We've been playing for the last 12 years with the same group. Standing ovations every night because it's a really it's an honest, authentic show that people will love.
Looking forward to it, Herb. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, man.